This weekend, hundreds of thousands of Americans boarded flying behemoths carrying moms, dads, kids, and grandkids miles up in the air for short hops and transcontinental hauls. For air travelers, the invention of the flying machine, in retrospect, seems as inevitable as turkey leftovers on Thanksgiving weekend. But so much now is so different from 100 years ago, when Orville and Wilbur Wright first got a plane to fly at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, on December 17, 1903. Their accomplishment has been cast on countless bronze plaques and immortalized in words and music, turning the two Ohio inventors into legends. Orson Welles recites from the Airborne Symphony.
It was a windy day in North Carolina, windy and light. Sun was shining, air was cold and bright. Couple of brothers, the brothers Wright.
Real people tend to fade away behind the legend. To rediscover the Wright brothers, producer Taki Telenitis and reporter Hal Cannon of the Western Folklife Center uncovered archival tape recordings. With the recollections of people who knew Orville and Wilbur, Hal Cannon reports on the work of two secrecy-obsessed aspiring businessmen, long before anyone imagined their labors would be the first small steps leading to the moon.
Long before Wilbur and Orville Wright became legends, they were simply Uncle Will and Uncle Orv to their niece Ivanette.
When I was about 6 years old, I was sitting on Uncle Will's lap, and he said, can you write your name? And I said, yes, I could. He pulled a little notebook out of his pocket, so I wrote it, Ivanette Wright, in a child's scrawl. Many years later, I found out that that was his notebook of the experiments of 1902.
A very important year for the Wright brothers. Since 1899, they had set out to solve the mystery of flight. Flying had tantalized great minds since the ancient Greeks and continued to stump the best scientists and engineers of the day. After collecting and absorbing all that had been written about flying, the Wrights began their own experiments. They built gliders with wings covered in fabric, sewn mostly in the dining room of the family home. Ivanette Wright Miller.
Orville on the floor drawing the lines and Wilbur using the sewing machine.
They flew their first glider in the fall of 1900 at Kitty Hawk, a spot they chose for its isolation and consistent winds. Returning to North Carolina over the next 3 years, they methodically improved their design through rigorous testing, both in the air and with one of the first wind tunnels ever built. They tested their ideas on each other, proposing thoughts, then breaking them down.
When they were sitting in their parlor, one of them would make a statement, and then there'd be a long pause, and then the other one would make a statement, and then the other one would say, "Tisn't either," and then it would be, "Tis two, tisn't either, tis two." And before they were through with the argument, each one had presented it so well that they'd be on the opposite side.
One of the Wrights' most revolutionary concepts was that turning in midair was like riding a bicycle. Banking was the key, not just steering with a wheel or a rudder. Their propeller also broke new ground, for the first time creating enough thrust to push an airplane through the air. By the fall of 1903, they'd incorporated these ideas into a new plane, outfitted with an engine they'd designed and built with their assistant Charlie Taylor. They left Dayton for Kitty Hawk on September 23rd.
Of course, the whole family were sure they were going to fly. They knew they were going to fly. They was just sure.
There you go.
The Reverend Milton Wright received a telegram. Success. 4 flights Thursday morning. Started at level with engine power alone. Average speed through air, 31 miles. Longest, 59 seconds. Inform press. Home Christmas. Orville Wright.
The Wrights assumed the press would jump on their story, but they were wrong. Only a handful of papers reported the news, botching the facts. Even in their hometown, this is how one editor reacted to that momentous telegram, former Mayor Henry Stout.
Martin Beard, who was the city editor of the Journal, was called from a card game to receive that wire, and he came back to the table, picked up his cards, and said to the boys, "Those Wright boys are coming home for Christmas, isn't that nice?"
People thought they were nuts.
Tom Russell worked for the Wrights from 1910 to 1915.
Well, you couldn't blame people because people couldn't visualize a great big plane flying up in the air, you know. See, it was against their good judgment, see.
The Wrights didn't let disappointment slow their work. Yes, the Kitty Hawk plane had flown, but the invention needed many improvements. Over the next couple of years, in a secluded cow pasture just outside Dayton called Huffman Prairie, the Wrights' contraption matured into a practical flying machine. The brothers worked on the motor, strengthened the landing gear, and tweaked the steering controls. They also placed the pilot in a seat instead of on his belly across the lower wing. William Huffman remembers going out to check on their progress after school one day in 1905.
As we were walking up to the farmhouse, they started up in their plane, and the farmer's son came along in a wagon in which he was hauling corn, and I sat up on the wagon and we watched them. They circled the field 38 times and the flight lasted 37 minutes. They came down because they ran out of gasoline.
With a more agile flying machine, you might expect the Wrights to have staged some grand demonstration just to prove to a disbelieving world that they had unlocked the secret of flight. Instead, they locked up their plane, not trusting rival inventors to get too close. Ivanette Wright Miller.
It's a funny thing. They could both stand anything but dishonesty. A person could do everything wrong, but if they were honest, they would forgive them everything.
Many pretenders would stop at nothing to lay claim to the aviation crown. The Wrights had commercial ambitions. They wanted a government contract to build planes. And they expected officials to take them at their word. Fearful they would be robbed, they didn't even show photographs of their flights. Rebuffed by the U.S., England, and France, the impasse continued for almost 3 years. And by that time, the competition, particularly in France, was closing in on the brothers. Finally, the Wrights got contracts with both the U.S. and France and were ready to make a public showing. Arriving in Paris for the exhibition flight, Wilbur discovered that their plane had been badly damaged in transit. It would take almost 2 months to make repairs. Already pegged as bluffers, French impatience and methodical Yankee ingenuity did not make a good mix. Nephew Horace Wright.
They got called in the bluffer or something that way. But the funny thing of it is you couldn't hurry Wilbur. He was going to get it right. And then one day...
August the 8th, the critics were silenced. Even the French aviators were humbled.
Les frères Wright s'attachent à l'époque héroïque de l'aviation.
It's Wilbur and Orville Wright who has shown the world their flight in their aeroplane.
Nearly 5 years after Kitty Hawk, Wilbur and Orville Wright were crowned the kings of the air, even in their hometown.
Now Dayton, she was slow, but the whistles they did blow when the boys returned from foreign lands with honors of their fame.
We heard from the news report that Uncle Will had taken a little French girl for a flight.
So Ivanette and her sister begged to be the first American girls to fly, a request that their Uncle Orville happily obliged.
I had a little hat on with a scarf tied under the chin. I climbed into the passenger seat next to Uncle Orville, and he smiled a little bit. When he got everything all ready, Uncle Orville gave the signal, and took off. There we were in midair with the wind blowing in our faces. It was unbelievable. We went out over the trees and the telephone poles and circled Huffman Prairie when Uncle Orv was pointing to the electric trolley that was coming in the distance. He turned to me and he said, "Shall we take it?" I nodded. With that, he turned off the engine and the propellers, turned into the wind, and glided down to a perfect landing in time to catch the trolley. And that was my first flight, and I haven't been the same since.
Sky, dear.
Oh, you flying machine.
Jump in, Miss Josephine.
The airplane quickly swooped into popular culture, landing on poster art, postcards, games, comic strips, and movies. Airplane love songs were propelled off the charts.
Come, Josephine, in my flying machine, going up.
Me and Jane in the plane, soaring up to the stars.
Come have a ride around Venus. Come have a spin around the bar. You can make them hug and squeeze you too. Or if they don't, just say you won't come down until they do.
Some songs took airplanes to the heavens.
Oh, Jesus is my aeroplane. He holds this world in his hand.
Well, an airplane could buck a cowboy higher than any old cayuse.
Gets me a bird and away we go. She snakes about like a young bronco.
Naturally, I wanted to learn to fly after they had flown. And they promised to teach me when it was possible. So in January 1910, I was Orville's first civilian student.
Student Walter Brookins soon became teacher Walter Brookins. By 1910, the skies were filling with competitors. In response, Orville and Brookins started training a team of competition pilots out for speed and altitude records across the country, often for big prize money. William Conover was part of that team.
We was over the Washington Monument, and the motor caught fire. I got up out of the seat. You can imagine being 4 below zero and cold. Get up to get the fire out. I got the fire out of the thing finally after I got up on top. And finally I twisted and got the engine going, just like that. The engine hit and we hit. And it just, if the engine hadn't come another second, we'd buried us right there in the ground, you see.
Other pilots were not so lucky, as Wright mechanic Tom Russell remembers.
Now I'll tell you, Johnson was killed at Denver. Now what happened down there? Johnson was only up about 500 feet when this wing started to pull off. Mm-hmm. And he even got out of his seat. Pull it back, see? And of course it hit the ground and he was really massacred. And those spectators down there, they rushed on that field to get souvenirs, and his mechanic told me that one man pull this strut that went down through Johnson's body, pulled it right out and run away with it for a souvenir. Mm. Now, can you imagine people doing that?
You've got to be ready if you take this ride. Quit your sinning hand, humble your pride.
By 1912, six of the Wright brothers' original 9 pilots had been killed in accidents. And in May came an enormous blow. Wilbur died of typhoid fever at age 45.
For Jesus, the Savior's coming again to take us after glory in his heavenly airplane.
Orville would live another 36 years, but got out of the airplane business within 3 years of Wilbur's death. He'd grown weary of fighting patent infringements, and he just lost heart for the business. But as the surviving father of flight, he remained intensely interested in aviation.
Lucky Lindy, up in the sky.
Orville lived to see Charles Lindbergh cross the Atlantic. He lived to see the plane used as a weapon in 2 world wars, and he saw the day when the airliner left the ocean liner in its wake.
Good afternoon. We are speaking to you from the flight deck of this 41.5-ton Pan American Airways Transatlantic Clipper.
Orville was a confirmed bachelor. He was devoted to his sister Catherine and his nieces and nephews, and he wanted to spend as little time as possible in the public eye. He rarely spoke in front of an audience, and would not allow his comments to be published or recorded. This is the only known recording of his voice, here being greeted by inventor and industrialist Charles Kettering.
Hello here, Orville. How are you? I've forgotten some of our first speakers on the...
Like the reclusive Orville Wright, the plane that flew at Kitty Hawk also receded from public view. After its fourth and final flight in 1903, a gust of wind flipped the plane, causing serious damage. The brothers packed it in a crate and brought it back to Dayton, where it sat for years. Orville hoped that the world's first successful airplane could be displayed for all to see in Washington. But at the time, the Smithsonian had a stake in promoting one of its former officials as the pioneer of flight. At one point, Wright even considered burning the plane. Finally, in 1928, he decided to send the plane to London for exhibition. Orville Wright lived to see the dispute with the Smithsonian resolved, but he died in 1948 before the plane was returned to America. Many of Orville's tools and records were left to his nieces and nephews, who, before their deaths, saw to it that these treasures found their way to museums and libraries.
I don't know what to use that for.
It's a caliper of some sort.
It's a caliper.
But on this day, Horace and Susan Wright proudly showed a visitor their most cherished possession, a piece of the original muslin fabric from the Kitty Hawk plane that made a second famous journey, a journey that would have caused even the forward-thinking Wright brothers to gasp.
This is a piece of the cloth that went to the moon in Neil Armstrong's boot.
As Neil Armstrong stepped onto the surface of the moon, that fabric tucked in his boot, his words could have as easily been spoken by the Wright brothers as they flew into history at Kitty Hawk that day in 1903.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
For NPR News, I'm Hal Cannon.
Hal Cannon's story about the Wright brothers was produced by Taki Talanidis with research assistance from the Carillon Historical Park, the University of Dayton, and the National Air and Space Museum, and engineering help from Larry Holt of member station KUER. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen.